From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. One of Jessica Leahy's suggestions for parents who are helping their kids in school and in life is to back off. Don't be so protective. She knows that's way easier said than done. Parents have a powerful biological impulse to protect their kids. But over time, Leahy says, parents, including her, have bulldozed every uncomfortable bump and obstacle out of their way. And they had good intentions, of course. The idea was to help them succeed. But as it turns out, it doesn't actually work that way. Leahy has written a book that explores the importance of parents letting their kids fail. And failure, she says, makes young people better students and eventually more successful adults. She'll join us today to explain what she calls the gift of failure after the news.
Hey, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. If you like what you hear on the show, you can lend a hand by giving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Facebook. And we'd also really appreciate it if you'd share what you think about the show, or if you have some thoughts about a particular episode, share that stuff around on whatever social media platforms you happen to use. Thanks a bunch and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jessica Leahy is a journalist. She's a parent. She's also a teacher. And in the new book she's written, she tells this story of working with the mother of one of her students. The woman was worried her daughter didn't seem to love learning like she used to. And Leahy had noticed the same thing. She wanted to know why this had happened. And in fact, the book she wrote is just about that, how young people are motivated to learn. Leahy knew this mother had done what probably millions of parents do these days. They sacrifice a young person's natural curiosity and love of learning at the altar of achievement. Parents, she says, are measuring the progress of their kids through points and scores and awards, and mostly they're teaching their kids to fear failure. Leahy knew it was that fear that had destroyed this girl's love of learning. Now she just had to tell her mother the truth. And that's what the book is. It's that truth about failure and about motivation. It's hard to distill it all, but Leahy is asking parents to back off. The book is called The Gift of Failure, and Jessica Leahy is joining us to talk about it. Jessica Leahy writes about parenting and education for The New York Times and The Atlantic. She's a commentator also on Vermont Public Radio. I mentioned she's an educator and a parent, and some of you may know her, by the way. We should mention she used to live in Salt Lake City earlier in her career. She taught at Roland Hall St. Mark's School. Jessica Leahy, welcome to the program. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to start with the very first sentence in the book. This is in the introduction, in fact. You say, I became a parent and a middle school teacher in the same year. And you say that those twin roles have shaped the way you have both raised your kids and educated your students. Explain how. How have those roles become intertwined, and how have they shaped the way you're thinking about all of this?
Well, teaching middle school students is a real – it's a unique place. I mean, these are kids that are handed too many responsibilities for their frontal lobes to handle, which is really how childhood works. I mean, we're trying to get kids to a place that they can handle the tasks that life throws at them. And middle school is this unique place where we throw so many things at them that they're going to mess up because we throw more at them than they could possibly handle. We ask them to change classes. We ask them to organize all of that stuff in their locker and figure out what they need to get to all of their classes. And they're nowhere near ready to handle that. So I think having a little bit of patience with that process, not feeling bad about my parenting because I asked my kid to do something that they honestly just aren't ready for yet, yeah, has become a big part of my parenting.
You say in the book that you'd always had this suspicion that something was wrong with the state of modern-day parenting, but it seems like the real clincher was when your own son entered middle school. And then you say the problem started to become clear to you. Explain that. What is it that you were starting to see?
You know, from the very beginning, I had noticed that my students were just paralyzed when they started thinking about the possibility of failing, when they started thinking about the possibility of even making a mistake, of raising their hands when they weren't 100% sure of everything they were going to say. A lot of those qualifications of, you know, raising their hands and saying, this might be stupid, but kind of stuff that I just don't stand for in my classroom. But it was getting worse. It was getting worse and worse with each passing year until the year that I actually started writing the book. I had a lot of moments when I realized that things had gotten so bad with my students' inability to make mistakes that it was affecting their ability to function at school. And not just – I'm not talking about – they weren't learning as well as they could have been, which was absolutely true. I mean, it absolutely would paralyze them. I had a student once who messed up or didn't know the answer on question two on an exam, and I was walking around sort of touching each of the students' shoulders, just checking in on them. And I said, you know, just move on. Just go to the next question. You can come back to that one later. And he just looked up at me with these big blue eyes, and he said, I can't. And he couldn't. He couldn't move on knowing that everything wasn't perfect with every single answer going down the line. And he actually never did move past question two on the exam. And they couldn't write rough drafts anymore. They couldn't free write. It was all just too scary to write something that's not perfect. And that's, you know, that gets in the way of teaching. That gets in the way of our ability to get our students to think in innovative, creative ways.
And that was kind of the epiphany. Like, I need to write about this or really dig into this.
Yeah, I think, you know, I love research. I'm a big dork. I love, you know, being a teacher is fantastic for me because my students ask me questions and I say, I don't know, but I'll find out for you. And that's kind of how my life goes. You know, I don't know. And so I look it up. And so I started doing a lot of research on overparenting and on autonomy, supportive parenting and teaching and trying to figure out how I could be a source of help to my students. And you know, the more I was thinking about my students and the more I was blaming the parents, the more I realized that I was putting myself in a situation where I was looking a lot like a hypocrite because I'm a parent too. Yeah. And I was – if my students' parents were complicit, then I was complicit.
So here's a startling statistic from the book I wanted to ask you about. You say that one-third of new teachers quit after 3 years and nearly half are gone within 5 years. And one of the main reasons that teachers list for leaving the profession is parents. I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, because in the book you do not at all pretend that all teachers are perfect or that the education system is perfect, but you say really this one, this particular issue is really focused on parents. Is that fair?
You know, I think at first it was the first time I wrote the book, it was really skewed in that angry place because, you know, I got there because I didn't know what to do with the energy that was coming from the parents and the worry. And frankly, there were a few times when I was reluctant to get in touch with parents because I felt like I needed to protect my students from their parents, from their wrath. And not that I thought they were going to go home and get beaten, although, you know, God knows what goes on. But I had students who were really afraid of their parents and of their reaction. And I didn't like being put in a position where I felt like I was protecting them from their own parents. And increasingly, I started to think maybe I can't keep teaching if it's going to be like this. You know, I would get approached in weird places at parties. I stopped going to parties. I live in a small town and I stopped going to a lot of parties because after a couple of glasses of wine, some of my students' parents would have no problem whatsoever with informing me about, you know, what was wrong with my teaching. So, you know, it just wasn't as fun. And the kids were what kept me there. But that aspect of teaching wasn't fun anymore at all.
So, that seems like a really dicey thing to deal with. I guess you have standing because not only are you a teacher, you're also a parent. So you can say, look, I have this problem too. But it seems like this is the first obstacle you've got to get through is to say, all right, folks, we're not perfect as teachers. The system isn't perfect, but you've got to address the fact that this is an issue. That seems like the first step is getting parents to realize they're a big part of this problem. Is that right?
Well, and not only is that the first hurdle. The other part of that is that I can't write about my students and my their parents. I can't do that.
Yeah.
That's as much as I might want to. You know, recognizable stories are going to get me in a lot of trouble. So yeah. I was very, very lucky. I happened upon a research study out of Australia that was the genesis of this article I wrote for The Atlantic called Why Parents Need to Let Their Children Fail. And that study was amazing because it quoted guidance counselors and teachers and administrators with quotes that I could have written. I remember at one point one of the administrators at my school took me aside and said, "No, really, these really came from a study because these sound really familiar." And I said, "Absolutely, these are from a study. These are not my quotes." But then when that article went completely crazy, was shared over 100,000 times on social media, on over 100,000 times on Facebook alone, all of a sudden the emails started pouring in and I had hundreds of stories to choose from. So I felt like I was in this position where I had something to say and suddenly I had a lot of anecdotes to use that weren't necessarily mine that allowed me to say these things because most teachers can't. There are teachers out there saying some of these things on anonymous sites like where they're completely unrecognizable and no one knows who the blogger is and, you know, there's some great ones out there. But, you know, I didn't feel comfortable writing it as an anonymized kind of book. I needed to be able to actually really dig in.
So one thing you do mention, you do sympathize with the fact that this is tough for parents because in the book you mention how stepping in as opposed to stepping back, which is what you recommend, stepping in is one of those biological imperatives. It's kind of programmed into our DNA, so you get it. There is that inclination. We all naturally have this inclination to protect our kids.
Yeah, some people take real issue with sort of the, you know, biologically, evolutionarily speaking, we're programmed to do this. But my eyes were really opened up when I was reading the research of Wendy Grolnick, who's at Clark University. And she writes a lot about autonomy supportive parenting, but she also writes about this thing that she calls the pressured parents phenomenon that's highly contagious. And I don't, you've probably experienced it if you've stood on the sidelines at a sporting match and listened to the parents start to talk, or if you start to listen to parents at back to school night. I wrote an article called Back to School Night Made Me Feel Like a Bad Mom because, you know, no matter how great your mindset is, you go into these things and people start talking about the private cello lessons and the traveling soccer leagues and the advanced placement classes that they're taking at the local university. And no matter how okay you are with your own kids and no matter how great you think your own kids are doing, you start – your adrenaline and your cortisol levels, they really start to go up and you start to feel like you need to reach for your own ammunition. Okay, well, what's my kid doing? You know, and it's really hard to move away from that. But actually, that's what Wendy Grolnick says you have to do is step away. Just remove yourself from the situation because it's incredibly contagious.
But how do you – it seems like it's like the mutually assured destruction. No one dares back off unless someone else does, right? I mean, so if no one else is backing off, you figure your kid's going to take a hit. And so it makes everyone reluctant to make that first – it seems like there's a lot of courage involved in making that first step.
There is, and not only are other parents reluctant to back off, teachers can be – it can be difficult to sort of get teachers in the right mindset to think about this. A parent came up to me in a parking lot after a talk and said, you know, I really want to do this. I really want to back off. I really want to give my kid more autonomy. But I feel like the standards for grading have just shifted and that – you know, if the science projects that have been co-opted by the parents are the new A, then what is my kid going to get if he goes in with a project he really and truly made by himself?
Right.
And it's true. I mean, you know, I'm the parent who can't even, you know, can practically not even hand over the glue stick because everyone knows that I'm, you know, I'm the gift of failure mom. So my kid goes into school with these, you know, he has for the past couple of years gone into school with these projects that, you know, are things are stuck together in weird ways. And the handwriting's loopy and crazy, and he's sitting next to the kid who has the history of calculus on these beautifully printed out storyboards.
Yeah.
So, you know, someone has to, the teachers have to start actually calling parents on their interference and their meddling and their fingerprints on the homework. At the same time, parents have to stop doing it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we all, it's almost like we need to call a ceasefire and, you know, on New Year's Eve, everyone come out of the trenches and all shake hands and all decide, okay, moving forward, here's how we're going to do this thing. I hope that the conversation gets started. There's a whole chapter in the book on parent-teacher partnerships. And in that chapter, I go into really basic stuff, like here's how to approach this relationship and get it off on the right foot. And it's everything from, you know, being on time means being early to, you know, remember to send thank you notes, that kind of thing. Because I don't know, it feels like we need some instructions for how to get out of those trenches and actually meet each other on a level playing field.
But it's not easy. I mean, here's another startling statistic. You write about in 2012, 36% of adults between the ages of 18 and 31 still lived with their folks. And this is that parental behavior that you identify as, it's been called, I guess this is a psychological term, enmeshment.
It also feels like there's a bit of – this happens every time I write an article. There's always a commenter who says, well, this is all well and good for most kids, but it won't work for my kid. Or you're not being sensitive enough to the differences between, you know, all the kids. And it's true. You know, as a teacher, all of my students have been slightly different and had slightly different needs. And I know parenting bloggers, we talk about it as the special snowflake syndrome, where, you know, every child is their own special snowflake. But they are. I mean, from our perspective as parents, they are. My kids have very specific, very special needs. But, you know, at a certain point, we have to realize that there are aspects of education that have to work for everybody and not for every individual on an individual basis, one-on-one. That's called tutoring. But school is a very different thing. And, you know, kids have become so precious to us. And I, you know, the historical chapter in there talks about it a little bit, about how we got to this place. But, you know, kids are a huge investment, and we have very few of them now. And we tend to treat them as such.
When we get back from a break, I want to talk about a little bit about that history, how failure, as you put it, became a dirty word, how we kind of got to this point. Jessica Leahy is with us. Her book is The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us journalist, teacher, and parent Jessica Leahy. She's written a book that explores the importance of failure. Failure, she says, makes kids better students and eventually more successful adults. The book is called The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. She's going to be here, by the way, in November at the King's English Bookshop. We can give you details about that a little bit later on the program. She's joining us today from Vermont Public Radio. So let's talk a little bit about the history part. I loved this section. So let's start in the colonial days. What was parenting like in the 18th century?
We lost a lot of kids. I mean, there's a quote in the book at one point where the sight of a dead child was no more uncommon than the sight of a broken pitcher, that, you know, losing children was par for the course. And it didn't make it any less difficult, especially, you know, for the parents. But at the same time, it set up an expectation that there you would try to have more children and that you would lose some. And obviously that has definitely shifted over time.
Yeah. John Locke. This was interesting. The philosopher John Locke. He was kind of the Dr. Spock in some ways of that era.
He is a little tougher than Mr. Spock, but yeah, sure.
He favored reason over emotion, I guess.
There are some quotes. I had to stick italics in there because, you know, I had this picture of him with his hands on his hips, standing over a toddler having a tantrum in the grocery store. And, you know, he had only disdain for crying and for, you know, for getting sucked into kids' emotionality, that it was really something that we're not supposed to get engaged in.
But then you write about the early part of the 20th century, and this was interesting how children were valued for their labor. which of course leads to these terrible things, child labor conditions. And so these child labor laws you mentioned, they're a good thing, of course. But then you say that they shifted the perspective of the family and society that, and as you put it in the book, that measured a child's worth by their utility in the past. And then children become superfluous. They get transformed from useful to useless. Would you say something about that?
Well, you know, it's interesting to me. In writing the book, I tried to get a lot of examples of when kids really felt like they had a purpose. There's an example in the book. My friend and editor, actually, at the New York Times, KJ Delantonia, a truck went off of their driveway and it was stranded in the snow. And the kids, they let the kids have at it and try to get the car unstuck. And it was just the best day. KJ refers to this day as just a thrill to watch because the kids were problem solving all over the place. And it was like, okay, we all are going to rally together. We have this purpose. We have this thing we have to do. And the problem with removing – you know, obviously children need to go to school and before they had been working and they had been working on family farms and they had been working to bring income into the family. There, you know, when they worked outside the house, it wasn't for their extra spending money. It was actually part of the family pot and it was what kept the family going. But when we removed – when child labor laws came into the our society, which were great, kids running under the mills and running under the machinery in the mills and, you know, getting killed by falling pieces of machinery, it was horrible.
Yeah.
But we also removed purpose from kids, and especially as the idea that kids shouldn't work and the idea that their schoolwork is their work and that anything they do on top of work should be reimbursed. That idea of giving kids an allowance is actually a fairly recent thing that Ron Lieber's book, The Opposite of Spoiled, goes into that fairly in detail. You know, when you remove purpose from the human life, even if it's just a child, we seem to think that we don't need purpose until we hit the age of 18 or the age of 22 or whatever that magical time is. But that's not true. Kids really do need purpose.
And then the parenting expert kicks in. This is in the 1920s. You write about this where we kind of lose faith in the competence of American parents and we stop seeing kids as miniature-sized adults who could solve their own problems, and we start seeing them as vulnerable dependents.
Yeah, it was also just medicalized. We were supposed to not – you know, during the Victorian era, we were supposed to not believe in the competence of adults anymore. One of my very favorite scenes in literature is a scene from Great Expectations where they're sitting around a dinner table and the mother is completely incompetent with the children. One of the kids is sticking a fork into her own head and the nursemaid is waiting by the doorway kind of cringing, just wanting to get her hands back on this child that really she has been raising. And it's this great moment where Dickens is satirizing Victorian parenting as just these completely inept people who are removed from their children because, you know, you don't raise your own children. You give them to a wet nurse or you give them to a doctor. You give them to someone else to raise. But then all of a sudden, the rise of the parenting expert happens and then this amazing thing happens where Dr. Spock shows up and he gives power back to parents in the form of, you know, the words, trust yourself, you know more than you think. But if for two generations we've taken that away from parents and we've said, you don't know anything and definitely don't listen to your mother because she doesn't know, she knows even less than you do. You can only trust doctors to give you the exact parameters for how you should do this and how much food they should get and on what timing system. And then all of a sudden, Dr. Spock says, no, here it is. Here's the power. Take it back. That's wonderful and that's empowering and that's freeing, but it's also really scary.
Yeah.
I mean, any parent who's been freaked out the moment that the baby's handed to them and they say, okay, you're discharged from the hospital, go. And they're like, you know, you say, wait, you're going to let me take this baby home with me? I don't know what the heck I'm doing. How am I going to not kill it? You know, that it's kind of scary. So we start clinging at whatever we can, you know, whatever we can get in terms of affirmation for our parenting.
Well, and it's confusing too. I mean, it's like knowing which diet to follow.
Think about it. For a long time, there were no diet books, or maybe there was one.
Yeah.
Or maybe there were two. But and that same thing goes for parenting. There were some pamphlets. There was one book out there for a while that was kind of the handbook everyone had. And then, you know, we get into the rise of the parenting expert. And now you go to a parenting section in a bookstore, and I'm sorry, I've now participated in this, but it's many, many, many linear feet of bookshelves. Yeah. And you know, who are you supposed to believe, the person that says the baby should always sleep with you, or are you supposed to believe the person who says the baby should never sleep with you? Or,
exactly.
You know, it's very confusing.
And you do also point out in the book that there's this kind of natural cycle to all of this, at least in the modern world, that mm-hmm. the parenting pendulum swings back and forth. I like how you put it in the book. You say there's this action and reaction that constitute the history of our species. So are we just destined to keep going back and forth in this pendulum, not touching our kids, touching our kids too much? I mean, I guess the middle ground is sort of what you're trying to find.
It would be nice. I mean, I think in many ways, and I talk about this in the, I believe the line right after that is, you know, growing up in the 1970s, early 80s, I really did feel like I got to rest under that really wonderful shade of the pendulum as it passed right over me, because I think, you know, I had parents who, you know, were concerned if I wasn't around by, you know, dark. But at the same time, I spent big chunks of my day out in the woods or swimming or doing whatever, and they didn't know where I was half the time. But that was when all of the really cool adventures happened, and that's when I learned things, and that's when I, you know, got my sister to do terrible things and, you know, got to do all those fun things that we're supposed to do as opposed to being refereed every single second of our lives. You know, there's a lot of research out there about the power of play and creative play and how important that is to the development of everything from executive function to intellect. But, you know, I think we're in a place right now where we're so micromanaging every single aspect of our children's lives that we've lost sight of the big picture of what we're supposed to be doing as parents.
Let's go to the phones. Sarah is with us, calling from Orem, Utah. Sarah, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say first that I really appreciated what you said about being that mom that sent your kid to school to be okay with failure. I've oftentimes sent my kids to school with these all about me posters that you can absolutely tell they made versus, you know, other kids that you can tell their moms are a little bit more crafty and may have helped. So I really appreciated that. I also wanted to ask, my son, he recently just started in a gifted program here at school, and he's always been very talented at math. And for the first time, he's starting to not like math because he's failing in it. It's challenging mm-hmm. him. And I didn't know if you had any words of advice for how to help him celebrate that failure. I've always tried to help him celebrate failure in other ways and such, but I think he's just so used to excelling that to fail at it kind of scares him a little bit, and he's starting not to like it.
Such a great question. It's also, it's just a fantastic segue into a concept called the fixed and growth mindset by Carol Dweck. If you haven't read the book Mindset by Carol Dweck, I highly recommend you pick it up. It's fantastic. One of her classic experiments actually was with a math quiz where she gave this math quiz, and then when they got the results back, they either told the kids their score and said, oh, you know, you got an 8 out of 10, you're so smart. Or she said, you got an 8 out of 10, you worked so hard. And the kids who were given the praise that had to do with sort of the fact that they're just smart or they're not, that it's like this baseline thing that we have no control over, those kids got what's called a fixed mindset. They sort of thought, okay, my intelligence is fixed and ooh, I better not screw it up. And the kids who were praised for their effort went on to think, oh, you know, okay, the harder I work, the better that is in some way. And interestingly, the kids who had the fixed mindset were much, much less likely to take on challenge problems, which makes perfect sense because you don't want to be challenged because that's going to screw up the whole smart thing. People won't think you're smart anymore. And especially with math, we tend to get really excited about kids who are just good at math from the get-go. But if you think about it, math gets hard for everybody. I've interviewed Stephen Strogatz, a math professor at Cornell, and he talks about this all the time. You know, for kids who have sort of, you know, gone through easily elementary and secondary school and show up at college, and all of a sudden math gets really hard, and it can be a huge crisis of confidence because it's always been easy for them. So the the big advice I give anyone when their kid is having issues like this is to go back to the praise for effort. Do not talk about product. Do not talk about grades. Do not talk about scores. Talk about how hard you worked. Talk about what didn't go well in your preparation and what did go well in your preparation, and praise them for this idea, and tell them one of the things we know about the human brain is that the harder you work, the smarter you become. And that this is actually in Korea, for example, this is a big part of their understanding of intelligence. The harder you work, the smarter you become is sort of combined along with the sort of innate talents as their idea of intelligence. But we tend to just stick it onto this idea of you are what you are, and you're either good at math or you're bad at math.
Yeah.
And that's not how things work in other parts of the world. So we need to start thinking a little bit more about praising our kids and saying, you know, the harder you work, the smarter you become. And so yay you for working so hard.
You also say that kids who accepted those challenge problems said that the hard problems were more fun.
Yeah, I love that part. I mean, the kids who were really worried and scared of screwing up that I'm smart thing, you know, didn't want any part of the challenge problems. And the kids who wanted them, the ones with the growth mindset, said, well, of course we want them. Those are the ones that are fun. The ones that are fun are the ones we have to work harder at. So if we can foster a growth mindset in kids, that's number one right there. That's one of the best things that we can do. You know, that has nothing to do with what we teach them. This is all about how it goes down and how we praise kids and how we give feedback to kids as they learn.
Sarah, thanks. I wanted to ask you about motivation is a huge theme in the book. What it takes to motivate a kid. And broadly, we can dig, I want to dig into this actually, but broadly you say that the kinds of strategies that make us successful in the business world don't translate so well into parenting, particularly this idea that rewards.
Right.
Rewards for grades, rewards for stuff like that, it's a really bad idea.
Yeah, and I have to, you know, right off the bat, huge debt of gratitude to Dan Pink, who wrote the book Drive, because that was the first book I read before going to his source, which was the work of Edward Deci. He wrote this incredible book called Why We Do What We Do, The Science of Human Motivation. And Deci's work really looks at what happens when we give rewards for effort, or when we give rewards for all kinds of different things, but for doing tasks and even for creative things. And the short version of Deci's research is that rewards are disastrous for productivity and they're disastrous for creativity. And creativity, I mean, hopefully most of what you learn in school is a creative process of learning. And so if we're going to screw up creativity, you know, we're messing things up from the get-go. It turns out that rewards do have very limited benefits. If you're trying to get someone started or you're trying to just boost motivation out of the gate, then one or two rewards here are not going to mess things up. They can actually work really well. But then that's the problem too, because right out of the gate, they look like they work really well. And so we keep going with those rewards and, you know, inflation kicks in or kids get tired of the reward you were giving them and want something else. And, it's the problem like with the seal at the aquarium. You know, the herring is gone out of the bucket and motivation is gone. It's not like the seal continues to perform once the fish are gone.
Right. You know, this was – I loved this part of the book because you write about Harry Harlow, the psychologist who did this experiment with these monkeys, which – really seemed important in terms of whether or not an intrinsic or an extrinsic motivator. Maybe we should explain what the difference might be, and then you can explain this test, because I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, Deci is really – he's amazing. The book's incredible. He talks about this experiment that Harry Harlow did where with these locks. These monkeys loved to play with these little simple hasp, I guess you call them, locks. They loved to undo them, and then he would reset them, and the monkeys would do them again. So he thought, well, what would happen if I gave the monkeys a reward? And so he gave some of the monkeys raisins for undoing the locks. He thought, well, you know, maybe they'll go faster. Maybe they'll do more. And at first, you know, it seemed to work out okay. But then the monkeys who were being rewarded with the raisins just weren't interested in the locks anymore, whereas the monkeys who weren't getting the raisins continued to be interested in the locks. And that raisin is an extrinsic motivator. My Latin teacher self comes out at this point, the extrinsic, ex, out from outside of. something, a reward that comes from outside of us, whereas an intrinsic motivator, something that comes from inside us, that's where the good stuff is. Intrinsic motivation is what we need in order to achieve that wonderful state of flow that Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi talks about, that place where time seems to fall away and we're just engaged in the task for the task itself. You know, for me, it's cross-country skiing. It's just hard enough and I have to work just hard enough that time seems to fall away and I'm just gliding. And for my older son, it's guitar. And for my younger son, it's writing or Legos or drawing or Minecraft. You know, that intrinsic motivation, that's the only way we get to that state of flow. And for intrinsic motivation, there are actually a couple things we need for that. And we need to have some autonomy mm-hmm. over what we're doing. We need to feel like it's under our control. We need to feel competent at it. You know how hard things can be, and then all of a sudden you kind of get it a little bit, and that's when it starts to feel really good. And we need to feel like we're connected to either that we're connected to the people around us and we have support, or that the thing we're doing has some bigger connection to the outside world and to the world at large. So intrinsic motivation, I mean, for teachers, that's it. That's the Holy Grail. If we can get that, those are the moments where the bell rings at the end of the period and the kids don't move.
Right.
And you just don't want to mess with that. I mean, as a teacher, if it's happening in my classroom, I just step back and let it keep going because I'm scared to death to screw that up. And it really is the Holy Grail for teachers. So when we have a classroom of kids that are only motivated by extrinsic motivators, whether that's rewards, money for grades, you know, whatever form of raisin we tend to give kids, it really messes up our ability to teach.
Back to the phones. Randy is with us in Ogden, Utah. Randy, welcome.
Thank you. I'm a secondary educator in Utah, and kids and parents have gotten so used to trophies or rewards regardless of the actual achievement, that kids and parents are starting to expect the reward for no effort. I'm getting mm-hmm. parents that come in and threaten lawsuits because they admit that their child did not do the work, that they did the work. The parents and the child know it, and they still expect the A. And they're expecting that reward even though they're not achieving anything. I've actually had administrators tell me, just give them what they want because they want the community to make such a fuss that it gives the school a bad name and people start, And so I kind of feel like I'm caught in the trap that I want to teach them, but at the same time, sometimes I'm told just to give in to them.
Yeah.
Jesse, you've had your share of these kinds of conversations with parents, I'm guessing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't know a teacher that the minute we figure out, oh my gosh, this kid didn't do this work, either they plagiarized it or someone helped them plagiarize it, and the first thought is, oh my gosh, I have to call the parents. Because it's really quite rare that we call up or email or whatever, meet with a parent and get full support. It's rare enough that I described one episode of that in the book as being this wonderful situation where we supported the parents supported us, we were unified in the consequences for the kid really understood what was happening and didn't feel like they were torn between the parent, you know, demeaning the teacher and the teacher being upset clearly with the parents and all that kind of messy stuff. It's a really rare thing to get backup from families, unfortunately. But when it happens, it's really amazing. It's a powerful, powerful tool.
Jessica Leahy is with us. Her book is called The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. She's going to be giving a reading in late November at the King's English Bookshop. There are details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Jessica Leahy. We're talking about her book, The Gift of Failure. Here's an email from Corliss. Corliss mentions a journalist, Alfie Cohn, who wrote a book called No Contest. This was apparently popular in the mid-1980s. Corliss is wondering what kind of influence this particular book or this mindset of the evils of competition poor self-image, the idea of everyone being a winner. That was a big approach in the mid-1980s, moved into the 90s. What kind of effect is that having on the way parents look at failure, this fear of failure?
You know, I think it goes back even further than that. We have, you know, the self-esteem movement started in the late 60s, early 70s. And if you read, for example, the Gene Twenge's book, The Narcissism Epidemic, it's pretty clear that, that idea that if we could just bolster kids' self-esteem enough, we could put like a little force field, you know, put phasers up, force field around the kids so that any insults or any blows to their self-esteem would just be deflected magically when they went off to school. That just doesn't work. There's a big difference between what we're trying to do for them, which is instill confidence, and what I'm asking parents and teachers to do, which is instill competence. And competence is, you know, is confidence, but it's based on experience. And the problem is that we've not been letting kids have the experiences they need, and the and not letting them get that resilience that comes out of, you know, messing up and facing their own failures and the consequences of those failures to build real competence. And, you know, the discussion that's been going on that Alfie Cohn's been a part of for a long time and continues to be a part of, you know, people, we're so interested right now in protecting those moment-to-moment challenges to students' little bubble of self-esteem that, you know, we don't want to let that get dented. And I think there are a lot of discussions right now, and Alfie Cohn has brought up some great stuff about what grading kids and what assessing kids excessively does to them. I think that's a really important discussion to have. But the greater sort of debate right now in education has become so entrenched that, you know, we sort of have the – anytime we get into this discussion, we end up having a conversation about assessment and about Common Core and about all these testing issues that everyone is so worried about. And I think this is a part of that, but I think, we're going to have to – again, we need to get out of these entrenched sort of places and come together and have a real discussion about what's going to work for education and our kids in the long run rather than, you know, just slinging insults and slinging accusations out of our trenches at each other.
Let's go back to the phones. Christian is joining us in Provo. Christian, hi.
Hi. So I wanted to go back to the topic of extrinsic and internal motivators. I'm a student, a chemistry student here in the Valley at the university, and I wonder, I see med students in my classes or pre-med students who are really caught up on grades, really caught up in this perfectionistic mentality, and it's a burden on me being in a class with these individuals who aren't finding the joy in the learning, and it makes me sad too. So I really identify with what you said. My question is, how deeply do you think this impacts our society? You know, these are the people that are becoming our doctors, who are becoming, you know, businessmen and leaders, and women. So I wonder, you know, how deeply do you think it impacts us as a country, as a nation?
It's a good question.
Yeah, actually, it's funny you say that. My husband, who is a physician, he and I wrote an article together for The Atlantic a couple of years ago about how middle school failures lead to medical school success. He had gone into work one day helping out a medical student. He was teaching a medical school student, and he's at Dartmouth, and he gave feedback about the patient care to this medical student, might have even been a resident, and she just couldn't handle it. She started to cry, and, you know, he was very gentle with his feedback, but she had never really faced feedback. We have a whole generation of kids right now where constructive criticism is just seen as an attack. And P.S., many of the parents see constructive criticism as a bit of an attack, you know, to the point where one of my columns of the New York Times was about helping kids see constructive criticism as constructive, because we've gotten to the point where it's very difficult to give feedback. But it's so important. I mean, part of the debate right now in education is about how teachers can use feedback, how teachers can use assessment as this thing called formative feedback, so that we can use that feedback we get about our own teaching to move forward and make the teaching even better and help our students learn. But it is really hard for people to take criticism/feedback. Yeah. And, you know, it's really affecting, you know, learners. It's affecting teachers. Those medical students that have, you know, been working so hard to get the carrot, you know, at the end of the stick for so long, have a big awakening when all of a sudden the consequences of them messing up are not just about the fact that they might get a B+ instead of an A, but they could, you know, affect someone's life. Yeah. And they need to be able to hear feedback. And, you know, the fact that this came up with my husband and he noticed that we were both reading Carol Dweck at the same time for different reasons and different sets of students, it stood out as a particularly strong example of why we need to get that growth mindset going again in students of all kinds.
Christian, thanks for the call. Back to the phones. Perrine is joining us from Salt Lake City. Perrine, hi.
Hi. So my question more revolves around the difference between giving a kid a raisin and a target. My son is now 28 and doing fine, having graduated from college. When he was in high school, his whole goal in life was to snowboard. And he was in a college prep high school in Salt Lake, and his dad and I are divorced, and his dad's method of motivating him was to track all that stuff online and make sure he was doing his homework and this and that and the other thing. And that was clearly not working. And I said, dude, you want to go to school out of state? This is your junior year. This is your homework, not my homework. Give me a B average. So come about December, his college counselor says, how's he doing? And I said, I have no idea. He was like, are you kidding me? I said, no, I am not looking. His job is to get a B average if he wants to go to school out of state.
So and you gave him a target, not a raisin.
I gave him a target, yeah. And by golly, he beat it.
Jessica Leahy, that makes sense, right? I mean, you write about this kind of thinking in the book.
Yeah, the chapter on grades is really a big discussion of the – I get this question all the time. Okay, well, this is all well and good, but we have to deal with grades. Grades are the way we measure success at school. And, you know, there's a whole separate book to be written about whether or not that's appropriate. But, yes, we do have to deal with grades. However, kids are dealing with grades every day at school from all different angles. So my – you know, one of the things that I would – really like parents to do is to talk more about goals and targets. I think giving him a target is great. I think him coming up with that target for himself is even better. But micromanaging every bit of our kids' achievement and telling them what they should be hitting and telling them what they should be doing is clearly not working. So one of the things I talk about in the book is the importance of not only encouraging your kids to come up with their own goals. And I'm talking about like short-term achievable goals. And this is just something I stole from being an advisor in middle school. It's what we do in school. And we do it in our family, and the adults have to do it too. So we have to come up with a couple of goals, and one of them has to be a little bit scary. And mine tend to be, you know, places I'd like to submit work that I've never been, you know, gotten stuff accepted to before. And I fail at that over and over and over again. But when we let kids develop goals, they're their goals. And if they come up short, it's okay. It's kind of a safe place to fail. As for the question of parent portals for grading software, I'm happy to go into that, but a big, big disaster as far as I'm concerned.
Right. I think we have time for one or two more. Let's try Holly in Salt Lake. Holly, we don't have a lot of time, but
Hi.
Welcome. Hi.
Great conversation. Just wanted just a comment. I'm a teacher, I'm a parent, I'm an administrator, and when my daughter was in school, and her math teacher came to me and said she's failing. And I think she was afraid that I was going to be angry with her. And I said, no, it's okay to let her fail. It's totally fine. And she failed. My daughter failed. And I am telling you that was the impetus for her to get her stuff together. And she's like, oh, my gosh, I've got to work harder. And she worked harder, and it was really a turning point for her. And so I just, bravo, I support this program. It's really fantastic. So thank you for the conversation today.
Thanks, Holly. How do you?
I can't count the number of times I've said to a parent, you know, this B minus or this C or this F is going to be one of the best things that ever happened to your kid, and they never believe me.
Right,
they never believe me. But over and over again, it tends to be true.
Well, which I guess leads to. I mean, we could go through so many different things, how you create these new kinds of habits, establishing the right kinds of limits, the difference between independence and autonomy, all of these kinds of things. Well, they're in the book and people can access all of that. But I guess finally I wanted to ask you, let's return to that natural impulse that parents have to take care of their kids. How do you finally get parents to restrain themselves with all the stakes as they are? I mean, what's the thing that you think is going to work the best to get parents to back off?
You know, it was well after I'd finished writing the book. It hadn't been published yet. And I was walking with a friend. I was walking with KJ, my editor, in the woods. And I said, you know, my kid, he's still having such issues with organization. This is something I've documented over and over again in my column at the New York Times. And she said, yeah, but think about where he was a year ago. And I thought about it and I said, oh my gosh, he's in such better place than he was a year ago. And, you know, this idea, and I wrote about it in this piece called Parenting for the Long Haul, Not for the Moment. And that has become my mantra. You know, every single time someone asks me about how to start changing, how to start giving their kid more autonomy, I say, you got to change your mindset first. You got to start thinking about what your goal is. Is your goal that this exact homework assignment, this particular homework assignment is perfect for math class tomorrow and you therefore, you know, get helping on it? Or is your goal that your kid can do their homework on their own and you don't have to be a part of it and you raise a kid who's a little more competent, a little more independent, a little more able to be out there in the world and get what they need and self-advocate? In all of those tiny moments, you know, you really need to think about long-term as opposed to short-term goals.
Jessica Leahy, her book is The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. She's going to be here in November giving a reading at the King's English Bookshop. We'll have details on our website. Jessica joined us from Vermont Public Radio. Jessica, thanks.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.